side of his talk is determinant at a random point for you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. All right, so it's not the first my lecture. This program is a result, maybe some examples and some part of the material will be familiar to those who attended the lectures before. I will talk about a very special class of random point processes that naturally appears in random matrix theory and some other areas of mathematics. I'm going to use mainly blackboard, but on few occasions I just will use transparencies as well. All right. So first I just give you a few. Can you see something? So the story essentially started more than 25 years ago with the works of Machi, and she was essentially almost fresh PhD when she studied this subject. Second reference, it's a kind of Bible on point processes, is a book by Daly and Very Johnson. It's going to be second edition, and there are some papers here, and most of them can be found in archive, on Los Alamos archive. All right, so now I think I will use just blackboard. All right, so first I will discuss discrete situation, because it's just much simpler, and then I will come to the continuous case. So situation is the following. You have a countable set, E, called one particle space. So for now, we consider it to be countable. You consider a probability space, sometimes called also configuration space, which is, in this case, just collection of all subsets of E. In general, it will be collection of finite or countable subsets of E. And you consider a probability measure on such space. So what does it mean? It does not hurt to think about E as Z1. It will not change anything. You have a lattice, integer lattice. You have integers. And some of these integers will be occupied. Some of the sites will not be occupied. And then you just consider probability measure. So this is, can be thought as a discrete point process. Because, again, you can think about occupied sites as particles. And you can think about unoccupied sites as holes. All right. Now, the class of point processes that I want to draw your attention to is the following. Suppose that you have a kernel K, so you have a function.
And this is called a probability.
Yeah, you have a P probability measure. No, just for a minute, I'm just talking that if you have some measure, again, in discrete case, everything is elementary, so it's, of course, it's a very rich situation. Yeah. No, yeah, but now I will talk about the very special measures. And now, suppose you have some kernel, okay, which defines the following probabilities. You ask for the probability that all sites in some finite subset of E are occupied. If such probabilities are given by determinants, we talk about determinantal random point process. So in other words, suppose this finite set lambda has n elements, n points. Here you have n by n matrix with integers given by the values of the kernel at points of lambda. Well, there are a few immediate remarks that can be derived from this formula. Namely, it's clear that if you know the probability that, for example, these three sites will be occupied, if you subtract the probability that these four sites will be occupied and also the next site will be occupied, what you are going to have is the probability that, all right, first four sites are occupied and the next one is a hole, right? So as a result, essentially, once you know these probabilities, of course, you can calculate the probabilities of all cylinder sets. So let me explain what do I mean by this. Usually, I will use the notation, this notation, again, to mean that all sites in lambda occupied. So you can put 1 in the occupied site and say notation of this sort for sites in lambda 1 occupied, in lambda 2 vacant, right? And then you can immediately calculate the probability of a more complicated event, namely of this one. And this is just inclusion exclusion principle, nothing more in elementary linear algebra, but it's nice to write it anyway. So you will see it as a determinant of, again, n by n matrix. So we talk about the number of elements in lambda to be n. It will be determinant of n by n matrix, and the formula is the following. In a second, I will explain, let's say, c lambda 2. So by this I mean the following. You have a set, finite set lambda, which is a disjoint union of lambda 1 and lambda 2. P lambda 1 is just a projection on the first, let's say, on set lambda 1, and P lambda 2 is a projection on set lambda 2. So in particular, if you see that if lambda is equal to lambda 1, what you see is just the old formula. All right? So anyway, even if you don't follow this, the point is that using trivial exclusion-inclusion principle, you can write down these probabilities, but the remark is the following. You can see that the particles and the holes have some duality. Namely, if now I consider a new probability measure, when I replace all particles by all holes, and all holes by all particles, then this new point process will be again determinantal point process. But the kernel now will be not k, but identity operator minus k. So we have this duality. And physicists like to draw attention to this fact. Anyway, now I want to talk a little bit about the importance of such things. And In my research, I first became interested in the continuous point processes because of what I explained, obvious applications to random matrix theory. And at some point, just probably it's the usual situation in mathematics, you just realize that you're doing some arguments, actually, that are valid for a much more general situation. But what happened after that, it just appears that such point processes are extremely important in many areas of mathematics. And in the discrete case, the applications range from probability theory to representation theory, to combinatorics and to statistical physics. So mainly now I will talk about the works of three Russian mathematicians: Borodin, Ольшанский and Окуняков, who essentially by training work in representation theory, and they start harmonic analysis on infinite symmetric group. And maybe I should add that it's a really remarkable story because Ольшанский, who is now in 50s, he works in Moscow. He had only 3 students because he worked in quite obscure research institutes. And two of them are Borodin and Akunkov. Borodin, after one year after PhD, became full professor at Caltech, and Akunkov, a few years after PhD, is a full professor in Princeton. So the guys really doing remarkable stuff. So the first thing is okay. I mean, it's kind of, also around like all of us. No, he's doing research, but, all right, so essentially what these people did, I will not talk much about motivation, but they studied certain measures, Z measures and Schur measures. On partitions. A partition is just a collection of non-negative integers. Say, the number of these integers is not fixed, but you have certain monotonicity conditions. So numbers are non-negative, but they do not increase. And also, the sum is equal to n. Whatever. All right. So they studied measures on such partitions. And in particular, these measures have infinite number of parameters. So you have a rich class of such measures. Very special case, and this example I already talked about, is concerned with the Ulam problem. And I just cannot help but talk maybe 2-3 minutes about this because it's really so famous Ulam problem. And actually, to some extent, it was always a kind of a motivation a little bit behind this stuff. And in Ulam problem, essentially, you consider all partitions of n. And partitions, it's known from representation theory, they label irreducible representations of a symmetric group. So you consider a measure on partition, which is just which given by some formula. It's not important, but it's just dimensional representation squared divided by n factorial. In particular, one can see that it's indeed probability measure, if you remember a few facts about representation theory. So this is called Poincaré measure. In general, Z measures and Schur measures have more complicated form, but they can be degenerated into Poincaré measure after one uses certain special parameters, essentially. And the importance of this measure, among other facts, comes from the following observation. There is a very nice part of combinatorics built around Robertson-Chesnut-Knuth correspondence. And if you say open, for example, the book by Stanley, there is essentially many sections devoted to this stuff. And in particular, this is the following list. If you let's give you a one-to-one correspondence between permutations of a symmetric group and some object, which is, I will not dwell on this at all, it's called pairs of Young tablors. Yes. Of shape lambda. So both of these tablors have the same shape, and shape is exactly a partition of n. So as a result, if you start with some measure on a symmetric group, you have, using this correspondence, you will induce a measure on partitions of n. And if you start with a uniform measure here, then the induced measure here will be Poincaré measure. And the beauty of this correspondence is that there is a very nice object associated with the permutation, which is called the length of the longest increasing subsequence. And Stanislav Ulam was interested in the distribution of this object. Once one considers a uniform probability on symmetric group, then this becomes a random variable, and the question was how this random variable behaves and then goes to infinity. And he attracted many other top mathematicians to think about this problem, and many did. But for essentially almost 50 years, there was not so much progress, but eventually people were able to prove remarkable result, and they just will need it a little bit later. So this mathematical expectation up to terms of much smaller order, this is a square root of the variance, and people were able to show even that the limiting distribution exists. So as n goes to infinity, this converges to Tracy Williams distribution, very famous distribution in random matrices. I will talk about it later. So it was discovered the connection between Ulam problem and random matrix theory. This distribution, Tracy Williams distribution, is essentially the following beast. You consider a random Hermitian matrix that Alex Gambert tried to explain in his lecture, and you look at the largest eigenvalue. You consider proper rescaling, let n go to infinity, n is the dimension of the matrix, and in the limit you all have limiting distribution. So the limiting distribution of the largest eigenvalue of random Hermitian matrix is coincides with the limiting distribution of the length of the longest increasing subsequence. Immediately, yeah, this result actually is due to Baik, Percy David, and Kurt Johansson, and it's 1999. I think it's in American Mathematics Journal. The immediate conjecture was the following. All right, one can talk about second largest, third largest, etc. Eigenvalues of Hermitian matrix, and then if you stupidly erased, if you think about partitions, then you also have natural analogs here, lambda 2, lambda 3, etc. And it appears that if you consider the same rescaling, yeah, maybe I should mention this. Perhaps I didn't mention. I'm sorry. So the main the importance of this algorithm is that if you consider Robinson-Schensen-Knuth's algorithm, then lambda 1 in this shape is exactly the length of the longest increasing subsequence. That's why people were interested in this. So essentially, here you can talk about partition, and you just talk about the first element here. It appears that one considers other elements, then they allow to prove essentially the same result here. And why? And the main tool in the proof was the following: one considers the Poincaré measure on partitions. As I mentioned, this measure has very complicated form, even though the explicit formulas are known, of course. And then one does the following trick: one considers a union of partitions where n is a non-negative integer. So here you have partitions of all non-negative integers. And one considers a new measure on this set. One first fixes some parameter, theta. Later we will talk about this parameter. And now one considers a measure on this set of partitions. And this is just a Poissonized version, so to speak. So in other words, the formula is just the following. All right, so in other words, you consider n as a Poisson random variable with the parameter theta. And first you place this random variable and discuss on which floor you want to consider your distribution, and then the conditional distribution is exactly the Poincaré measure. The beauty of this trick is the following. It is well known that if you have a random variable, which is Poisson with parameter theta, if you consider theta, say, let's say n going to infinity, then, so you have a sequence of random variables, all right. Then essentially this random variable is in the main order, it's just given by n. Of course, there are random fluctuations around n, but the fluctuations of order of square root of n. So this well-known fact. So, and as a result, here the idea is the following. Consider this new measure. It appears that it has a much more simpler form. Namely, this measure is a determinantal point process. So, this is the main observation. And since it's a determinantal random point process, it has some kernel. So everything just depends on this kernel. Let me denote the dependence of this kernel on theta by superindex. Now, the idea is the following. Let theta be equal to n. Study this measure. If you want to understand this measure, you just have to understand the asymptotics of this kernel, then goes to infinity. And this can be done because the kernel is actually can be expressed in terms of Bessel functions. So this is rather classical stuff. One can study this. As a result, one can study the asymptotics, the asymptotic properties of this measure when n goes to infinity. But now one can go back to the original Planckschreier measure because essentially for large theta, theta equals to n, the properties of this measure essentially mimic the properties of this measure. So one has to do a few technical steps, but this is the idea, and it's not extremely difficult to accomplish. So the main breakthrough in this problem was realization that Poissonized version of Planckschreier measures was just a determinantal point process. And using the same ideas, Borodin, Okunkova, and Dachansky were able to study the more general measures, and again, always they had a similar kind of situation. So this fact, and when people just realize that this all standing problem and many other exciting problems in the presentation theory can be solved using this machinery, essentially attracted a lot of people to this area. Maybe I should say that originally the idea that Ulam problem or related problems in combinatorics and representation theory are similar to random matrix theory problems was suggested by Sergei Kirov, who died 2 years ago. So this is first part. Second part of the lecture, I want to now to consider a general case, even though I will discuss, continuous case on R1, but one can easily generalize it to arbitrary Hausdorff space, say separable Hausdorff space. So now the situation is the following. Again, think about one particle space in just R1. And now probability space or configuration space will be again collection of finite or countable subsets of R1. So one can with the additional property that this configuration is locally finite. So if you consider arbitrary box minus LL and ask for the number of particles in this box, then the number of particles in this box is finite. Right? So this is a probability space. One can easily consider sigma algebra of measurable sets in the obvious manner, namely, if one considers intervals in R1, one can consider sets of the following nature. This is the collection of configurations when you know that in this interval you have exactly n particles. If one varies intervals and let n be arbitrary non-negative integer, such sets, the family of such sets is called cylinder sets, and Z generates sigma algebra. So certainly you want this sets to be measurable. You want to know the probabilities of such events. And then the small sigma algebra that contains the sets is exactly sigma algebra of measurable sets. So anyway, there is a nice way to consider sigma algebra. And again, if you have a probability measure on this object, you have a point process. Well, this is all nice, but the question is how you can characterize this probability distribution. Let's think about the simplest situation. In the case of Poisson point process, you have the following essentially thing. If you consider n intervals, let the length of these intervals go to zero, and then ask about the probability that in each of these intervals you have a particle. Then in the Poisson case, this probability is just given by the product of the lengths of this infinitesimally small intervals. So this is a simple situation. In other words, these events are independent from each other, and the probability is just proportional to the length. In general situation, what may happen? Well, not very general, but in quite general situation, what may happen is that this probability is still proportional to the product of the lengths of these intervals, but you have some factor in front, which depends on x1, etc., xn. If for general factor like this, then the probabilities, the events to find particle here, 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 are not independent. Again, this factor depends on all n points, but this gives us quite a general class of point processes, and these functions then are called n-point correlation functions. Please recall that in the discrete case, n-point correlation functions were just the probabilities that we have particles occupy n sites. Here, in the continuous case, you have a very similar situation. All right? So, the class of point processes that I want to consider is before is characterized by the fact that correlation functions are just determinants with certain kernel. So in other words, you have a kernel, which, if you wish, in this case, gives you an operator in L2, and you have this formula. This formula holds for all n. All right. A few examples. The first example was, again, essentially discussed by Gambert earlier. It appears that the most classical ensembles of random matrices do have this property, and I just want to briefly discuss these ensembles. The simplest maybe ensemble is the ensemble of Hermitian matrices. And if you consider the probability measure on such ensemble, then up to normalization, this measure is given by this simple formula, where dA is just Rebec measure. So, in particular, people studied a lot the case when Vx is just x squared. In general, one can consider, say, polynomial of higher degree, or maybe even some other function sufficiently smooth. This case, Vx equal to x squared, corresponds to the Gaussian ensemble, because then matrix entries are Gaussian. So this, the Gaussian case was ensemble studied by Wigner 50 years ago, and essentially one can calculate practically everything about this ensemble due to the fact that correlation functions are given by determinants. Of course, then the question remains if you can study things in the limit n goes to infinity, but in most cases, it can be handled without much difficulty. So the key observation is the following, that for such ensemble, if one calculates k-point correlation function, which is in this case can be understood to be the following integral, I will explain this in a little, in a minute, what do I mean by this manipulation, but so what one does, one first calculates the density of the distribution of eigenvalues. Matrix A. So indeed, of course, you have n eigenvalues. All of them are real, and they are random variables because you start with a random matrix. And they have joint distribution given by this density. And if one just think about the situation in the context of point processes, one can think about n particles on the real line. So you have configuration of n particles. And correlation functions are given by this bis, and the beauty is that correlation functions are again determinants. And this is a very special kernel. It's essentially it's a projection kernel. So again, the fact is that one can calculate the asymptotics of this kernel in the limit n goes to infinity after proper rescaling. So this fact allows to study many statistics of eigenvalues of random matrices. And a very similar situation holds for many other ensembles of random matrices. So I just mention them without writing down any formulas. One can consider random unitary orthogonal symplectic matrices with respect to Haar measure. In other words, we have a natural measure on groups of such matrices, and if one considers this measure, then a matrix element in this group becomes a random element, and you can study the eigenvalues of such a random matrix, and again, you have very similar formulas that essentially allow you to calculate practically everything that you want to know, even for large n in the limit. Similar situation holds for positive definite matrices. So if you start with, say, matrix A, n by m matrix with IID, Gaussian entries and considers new matrix, then again a similar situation holds, and actually one can generalize this ensemble to some degree. I don't want to talk about this. One can also study chains of matrices. So, in other words, one has M Hermitian matrices, and one considers a joint distribution of these matrices coupled in a certain way, and which generalizes an example given in A. And again, one has similar formulas, and there are some other cases where one can do similar tricks. So, if you wish, this was, at least in my case, the main motivation to think about such processes, because in all these ensembles you do similar things all over and over again. Now, again, in the continuous case, in the last 3 or 4 years, just the field exploded with many surprising applications in probability theory, in two-dimensional random growth models, in exclusion processes, and in many other areas, where people were able finally to achieve some breakthrough realizing that in the bushes one has determinatal formulas like this. Now I want to maybe to use transparencies and to talk a little bit about general results. So, the first natural question is the following. And this is very general theorem. And again, if you want, you can think about a one particle space, either R1 or Z1. But one can talk about a general Hausdorff space, and one can do the same thing. So you have a kernel. And the question is, what are the conditions on this kernel that this kernel defines determinantal random point process? So, and it appears that existence and uniqueness theorem, it's a very simple one. Namely, the conditions are the following. If you have Hermitian kernel, of course, it must be locally traced class, meaning that if you consider this operator and restrict it to finite interval, then the restriction must be trace class operator. Then this operator must be just non-negative, and also eigenvalues should not be greater than 1. So, as all general theorems, the proof is not very difficult, and just want to. Doesn't work. And I just want to mention very briefly what's going on here. Well, it's fine, probably. I mean, it's. All right, thank you. And essentially, to some extent, this result was proven by Machi in her papers in 1975, but it was not completely correct, but many ideas are already there. And the reason why I explain the proof is just explain some nature of such processes. All right, so you have endpoint correlation functions given by some nice formula, supposedly nice. Endpoint correlation functions are very useful for the following reason. One point correlation function is just a particle density. Namely, if one considers interval, say alpha beta, and one asks for the number of particles in this interval, then mathematical expectation of the number of particles is just this integral. And one can easily derive it after staring 10 minutes of the definition and just using nothing more but rudimentary probability skills. In general station, one can calculate higher moments. The only knock is that one has to calculate factorial moments. And again, factorial moments are just given by the corresponding integrals of correlation functions. And as I mentioned, this is just an observation. It's nothing special. Well, but now if you have a determinantal formula, it means that if you calculate factorial moments, you just integrate determinant. And this is up to a factor, just a trace of exterior product of our operator restricted to interval I. So this is a general fact. If you consider, for example, just trace of operator K, if you have nice, rather mild conditions in the kernel, then the trace is just integral of the diagonal over interval I. In general, you have this fact, and again, in the field, it's a very standard fact. It allows you to calculate the generating function. So in probability theory, if you want to study the distribution of a random integer-valued random variable, it's enough to calculate such mathematical expectation. Of course, one can. It's given by this formula. And if one uses this fact, one realizes that it's just what's called Fredholm determinant. This is trace class operator, so it has eigenvalues. And this determinant is just, of course, the product of 1 plus lambda I over all eigenvalues. So it's just a usual determinant, if you wish. Now, the fact is the following. You see, this generating function, by the very definition, must have non-negative Taylor coefficients. And this forces, of course, some conditions on K. From the very beginning, operator K must be non-negative because all minors are non-negative, because they are just essentially give you the probability, so they are negative. This forces operator to be non-negative. But the condition that these coefficients are non-negative as well forces this operator to be not greater than identity. Essentially, of course, one has to study compatibility conditions and so forth and so on, but this is essentially all what you have to do. All right, and now I want to talk a little bit about one more example of random point processes. This example is interesting in many respects. You see, determinantal random point processes by physicists actually even called fermion random point processes, in fact, because of this formula. And in practically all applications, you see strong repulsions of the particles. In particular, in random matrix theory, you have strong repulsion of the eigenvalues. The question arises, can you find random point processes with determinantal correlation functions that have independent spacings, so you don't have repulsion in some sense? And so this is a standard part of probability theory. It's called the theory of renewal processes. What you have an independent identically distributed non-negative random variables, tau j, and now you consider your particles, the coordinate of your case particle, just be equal to the sum of these random variables. Then, of course, tau j just plays the role of spacings, which is the distances between neighboring particles. And I consider them to be independent. So such process in probability theory is called renewal process. And it appears that determinantal random point process, on R1, has IID spacings if and only if you have these two conditions satisfied on the kernel. Well, unfortunately, one cannot easily rewrite these conditions in terms of distributions of tau. One has some system of equations, but nothing nice looking. Nevertheless, in the special case, when the field is translation invariant, I will talk a little bit about this next two slides, in the simplest situation, so to speak, then the kernel is just given by this nice formula, which gives us the density of the distribution of the interval. One can solve this completely. So again, for me, this example was very unexpected, because all people who involved in this business believe that you have strong repulsion, and you do. But nevertheless, sometimes you have this features. Now let's talk about translation invariant point process. So now I will talk about one particle space, either RD or ZD. And so again, configuration or probability space is just a collection of particles. And one has obvious shifts. So we just shift any particle by T. So this is a dynamical system. It appears that if a determinate random point field is translation invariant, well, this happens if and only if one has obvious translation invariance for correlation functions. And translation invariance, of course, means just that the measure is preserved under these translations. So suppose you have this condition. Of course, if you want to write it in terms of a kernel k, in the determinate case, this means that the kernel depends only on the difference of x and y. So then, indeed, it's translation invariant. Well, people were interested in the properties of this dynamical system, and I will just very briefly sketch these properties. It appears that this dynamical system is very chaotic. Even though the particles, the configurations are very rigid because of the repulsion, nevertheless, this dynamical system is very chaotic. And essentially, one can prove practically everything that one wants to prove about chaotic dynamical system. I just mentioned that one can prove ergodicity, mixing property, and spectrum is absolute continuous, and even more. But this is in the general situation. For convenience, I just write down the definitions of these properties. And in the discrete case, practically one can prove everything. And this is the work of Japanese mathematicians, Shirai and Takahashi. They considered the same kind of problem recently, and they proved that entropy is positive. And actually, under rather, well, here it's a rather restrictive condition, but then some people lifted it. One can prove that it's even a Kolmogorov system. So it's as chaotic as you want. So, all right. What else? A second area that people tried to study involved the linear statistics and related questions. So it appears that and in some generality, first it was proven by Kostin Ribowitz, then it was noticed by Widom that can be extended, that there are some other papers. It appears that one can prove the following amazing fact. First of all, what is linear statistic? You consider some nice test function f, say with compact support. You have your configuration consisting of particles xi. One considers this sum. So if xi is just eigenvalues of a random matrix, this is just the trace of f of the matrix. And in random matrix theory, people were interested in this object for a long time. In particular, one can think about special situation when f is just indicator. If f is indicator, then the thing that you have here is just the number of particles in the set, say, I. And it appears that one immediately has a central limit theorem. So once the variance grows to infinity, central limit theorem holds. And please note that this result holds in the in general situation as you want to. So you have a sequence of kernels that defines a family of kernels that defines a family of determinate random point fields. One has a family of intervals, and that's it. All right. Essentially, I probably will just talk for 5 more minutes, and then I stop and. The proof is somewhat simple, as always, for general results. Namely, one studies the cumulence of the number of particles. And for arbitrary kernel k, one has this rather nice formula, where this is some constants. And in particular, second cumulant is just the variance, and it's given by this trace. And if one wants to prove if one wants to prove a central Riemann theorem, it's certainly enough to show that a second cumulant variance grows to infinity, and higher cumulants grow not faster than the second cumulant. So if one looks at this formula for a little while, it's enough to show that the stress is big O of the variance, and this immediately follows from the fact that the kernel is between zero operator and identity. Maybe I skip this. I just want to mention one can prove somewhat similar result for general test functions, but here conditions become somewhat not so nice, and you just have it here. But again, the central Riemann theorem holds in a rather general situation, so this is nice to know. So, Sasha, here I consider a rather general test function. It's not an indicator now. So, in particular, you can forget about this condition or think that all test functions are just uniformly bounded. The unfortunate condition that I need is I need to know that the variance goes to infinity, because in some stations in random matrices, actually the variance even stays finite. And I need to know that mathematical expectation doesn't grow much faster than the variance, so it grows only at some power of the variance. Again, for general random point fields with null correlation functions, this is true. You can easily check these conditions. Unfortunately, in random matrix theory, you have very special kernels. And for nice test functions, just this condition is violated. And then you have very delicate combinatorics, and one can also do these things, but not in this lecture. All right, and so I will finish with the following three slides very briefly. Maybe I will put it here. So if one considers translation invariant case, so the kernel depends on the difference, then the condition of the kernel just means that the Fourier transform is between 0 and 1. And the key role is played by the spectral density, in this case, by the function m lambda, which is given by this formula. And just then the variance can be calculated easily in this fact. And there is a nice connection with the theory of stationary sequences. So in particular, if one wants to study the variance of the number of particles, one can see that the leading term is given by the value of this function is the origin. Therefore, in the non-degenerate case, when this is not zero, the variance grows as a volume. The degenerate case happens if and only if this is a projection. And this is a very typical case in random matrix theory. So in random matrix theory, the kernels are very degenerate, so to speak. And then it's, of course, makes everything much more difficult because the variance grows not as fast and the station is just much more complicated. And, in the non-degenerate case, when m at the origin is non-zero, one can just see the convergence to the white noise. In the degenerate case, in the case when m at 0 is 0, one has to study the behavior of m near the origin, and one has a central Riemann theorem of this nature. So I just flashed probably very too quickly these transparencies. So I want to just finish with one remark. There is a similar family of equations related to these equations. Namely, one can study the distribution of spacings in, say, random fields, so in general natural random point fields, and one can also prove a central Riemann theorem for such in such station, but the analysis becomes much more complicated. So
are there any questions, comments?
suppose you have a point process, how can you see whether it's determinant or not?
So you no, but first of all, correlation functions just play the role of the moments of a random variable. The same thing. So if you have a random variable, you can describe a distribution, provided that moments do not grow very fast. Mm-hmm. Either knowing a distribution function, or knowing, say, Fourier transform distribution, or knowing moments. The same situation holds for point processes. Either you have to know the probabilities of cylinder sets, so the probability that in some interval you have exactly n particles. But then, of course, you have to worry about compatibility conditions, because you don't want to have the probability of having no particles in largest interval to be smaller than something, and such things. Or, so you have this, if you know the probabilities of cylinder sets, this is analogous to knowing the distribution of a random variable. Or you can know correlation functions. In many ensembles, in many situations, it's just much easier. Say, Poisson case, if you think about Poisson ensemble, what all of you want to say is that particles are independent and the density is 1. This means that k-point correlation function is the product of 1-point correlation functions. 1-point correlation function is 1. So, and again, if you know correlation functions, then by integrating over intervals, you know the moments of the numbers of particles in intervals. So, in other words, this, the way to describe the distribution using correlation functions is very useful and actually quite general. And if you look at the original papers by Andrew Leonard, who originated all this field, he used correlation functions as a main tool. So in many cases, this is the main, the right object.
But my question is, how do we know they come from the determinant?
In many cases you just know explicit correlation functions. That's what I'm saying. It's just in most situations just the natural object. It's not something just I come in from the bushes and just push out here. Just the way you describe it, and then you just look at the formulas and then you see it.
Are there questions? Thank you again, and we meet again here.